Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Jay Rogers to the broadcast. Jay is the Chief Executive Officer of Local Motors, a cutting-edge automotive startup building the next-generation automobile and other vehicles. The company is at the epicenter of a number of rising trends, from micromanufacturing to 3D printing to self-driving vehicles to the concept of pre-tail. Prior to founding Local Motors, Jay served for 7 years in the United States Marine Corps, where he was an infantry company commander. Prior to his service, he worked as a consultant for McKinsey & Company and as an investment analyst at Ewing & Partners. Jay earned a bachelor's degree from the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University and an MBA from Harvard Business School. I recently caught up with Jay over the phone from Local Motors headquarters in Phoenix, Arizona, and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 4, IT and business partnerships, as we discussed how Local Motors forms strategic partnerships with clients, and Principle 5, external partnerships, as we discussed how Local Motors has created a community that drives innovation and efficiency. We also discussed how the company has relied on transparency to build teams, Jay's history in entrepreneurship, transformations in the automotive industry more generally speaking, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much.
Jay Rogers, I thought we'd begin with the business that you founded, that you run, Local Motors. It's a business that combines a number of leading trends, open source technology, the concept of micro manufacturing or micro factories, 3D printing, self-driving automobiles, a pre-tail, a co-creation, so many different topics of interest in the technology field and sort of rising trends, if you will. And I wonder if you could take a moment just to describe the business as it stands now. How would you describe Local Motors as a business?
Peter, Local Motors drives the commercialization of high technology products using co-creation and micromanufacturing. So when I talk to people about it, what I say is, you know, there's a lot in that phrase. When you drive the commercialization of high technology products, what you're literally doing is for your own account, and we work with some other large businesses that have similarly complex high technology products. It's about changing a 100-year paradigm of mass manufacturing and using the crowd to help you, using a bespoke community that you build with your suppliers and your customers, and then changing the way we think about manufacturing. We have a very mass-oriented way of thinking about product commercialization. And so in our business, our most successful product is this, you mentioned it, it's a self-driving shuttle. And it's where we apply, you know, we eat our own dog food, so to speak. It's a new area, and it's one where there is strong customer interest and user interest for a lot of reasons. But to get the products out, companies that are more traditional in the industry have a much longer timeline because of the way that their processes are set up. So that's how I describe our business.
That's great. You mentioned the bespoke community, the ecosystem that you have developed, and actually that so much of the creation depends upon that strong collaboration with the community. How do you foster that? How do you select them? How do they select you?
Great question. So this is something that we're very passionate about. We have moved into, as Steve Case called it in his recent book, a third wave of internet-enabled businesses. And what we think about when we think about community is not numbers, but we think about relevance. And so our community is something that's a breathing entity, and nothing is more real in this age of questions about reshoring jobs and of constant upheaval in union memberships and micro degrees where a college degree is under attack. When we think about a community, we're looking for businesses and individuals to join in a effort, this is why I call it bespoke, that it has relevance to something they know. And we stand up that community around what is really known as best, simple words, as a project. And we scope very carefully what's needed in that project. So if we're looking at something that needs metallurgy or material science or integration or controls or you name it, it can get, or let's say flight experience or, you know, knowledge of unmanned systems. Those are the kinds of things where there is a cognitive surplus of people out there that simply are never going to work for you. You need them more than they need you. But you can strike a transaction around a project if you can be open about what you're doing. And so the way we build a bespoke community, what could be thought of as a breathing team, one that, you know, sort of can expand and contract and understands the terms on which that happens, is about being really clear and open on the projects you're working on. And so that's been a big shift, because for our own account, we can do that because we control IP regulations and other things like that. For big companies that we work with, who we help advise, that's one of the first things that they learn in the way that we do things, is open development really allows them to build a breeding team.
And in terms of co-creation, you've worked with a number of leading significant brands, General Electric, Lego, Domino's, Airbus Group, to just name a few. I wonder, can you talk a bit about some of the specifics of these partnerships, the sorts of ways in which you engage large enterprises, and how they think of you relative to their traditional manufacturing, the extent to which some of those organizations that I've just mentioned have a more traditional manufacturing operation in various parts of their business, the sorts of things they're doing with you as opposed to the things they're doing internally?
Yes. So a couple questions embedded in that. So usually these customers come to us already with a lot of pain that is they're smarting from. It usually, you know, it depends on their product development process. They may be in a traditional 3-year development, 5-year development, 7-year development, 10-year development in some cases. And usually they are burned by the fact that most of their green lighting processes come up short better than 50% of the time, meaning they'll say, oh, we're going to build this product. They go after it. It takes longer, costs more, and is less successful than they expect. And so they have learned those lessons, and it gets more and more expensive to find innovation. And so they're coming from that attitude. And so that sort of sets the stage for what we do with them. Then what we'll do is we onboard these clients using services, and we start on the attitude of basically offering what is the best described as a community-powered SaaS platform. And so that's something a lot of companies are familiar with at this stage, which means you're using software as a service tied to the development of a community to begin to tackle problems. It's fairly well understood. And that can feel a lot like, you know, I'll be very frank, and I say this to our clients, it can feel a lot like innovation washing to people who aren't believers that the process needs to go faster. And what I love about Local Motors is that we believe that doing hard things is hard. And so there are a raft of companies out there that say, oh, I can offer you a SaaS platform that will tie you to 1 million users and you can touch them in an instant to do your graphic design or your software design or whatnot. There is nobody like Local Motors that understands that tying that idea creation to real suppliers, the ones that they perhaps already have in their network, and to real build methodologies, and then to real product commercialization, perhaps even brand new go-to-market strategies. And so we just sort of take the idea of what started with, let's say, Jeff Howe in his book on crowdsourcing, you know, back in the early 2000s. And we're bringing it into the third wave of industrial internet-enabled businesses, which is, yeah, we're going to come up with great ideas, and then we're going to tie them to your current supplier network and new supplier network, and we're going to talk about with that community how we're going to make these things. Then we're going to prototype them, and we're going to do it openly, right in the middle in front of the community, and then we're going to put these things in low-volume production. So that's kind of how we engage and where our customers are coming from when they get there. And they go through cycles of, oh my God, that's impossible. Or if it could be done, we would be doing it already. Those are some of the attitudes that can happen. And then all the way through to, wow, this is how modern companies really should be developing products. And it's grown not where we just handed them a product or a solution, but rather it's like, you know, the old adage, you know, teach a man to fish is much better than giving him a fish. So that's the way we look at that onboarding of those clients. And I got to, you know, say it again, it's because we do it ourselves. And in the ground vehicle world for our local motors community and efforts, you know, Ali is the best proof point. And we built the Rally Fighter and commercialized the Rally Fighter. That was the first vehicle that we made. And we've done a bunch of other vehicle programs for the military and for our own account. And so we eat our own dog food.
And continuing with those sorts of co-creation partnerships that you develop, the process then of taking the small scale manufacturing, the prototypes and early stage manufacturing to scale, what does the handoff look like on the back end of that?
It's not so much a handoff. When I was in the military, we thought about it as left seat drive is where the driver sits and then right seat drive is where the passenger sits. And then you swap off. So when we start with the customer, we'll be in the left seat driving and they'll be in the right seat. And then as we do the quote handoff, we stay in the right seat and they move over to the left seat. So we're still there together. So it's just, it's almost like it's training and staying, if you will. Our business is built around the success of their products. And so we don't just hand them a solution and say, see you later. And so this also is pretty important part of what we do. When we partner with a company, we want to tackle a whole vertical. So, you know, let's say it's going to be, you know, industrial machines, or it's going to be home building, or it's going to be plumbing, or it's going to be vehicles, or it's going to be outer space connected mining projects, or, I mean, there are whole verticals of areas that we tackle. And we like to find companies, if we're going to work with somebody outside, we don't need to work with outside companies. So I know we're spending time talking about it from a point of view of understanding what we do, but we're pretty choosy about when we do it because we're digging in hard with them and showing them a new method. You know, I don't expect to have thousands of these clients. I expect to have tens of these clients, but it is transformational for them and we learn along with their transformation.
You, for a time at least, had a very traditional business background. You worked in finance, you worked in consulting, you went to the Harvard Business School, but you also spent a number of years in the Marine Corps. And I know that actually it was your time in the Marines that in some ways led to the inspiration behind Local Motors. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about those early days, some of the insights that led to founding this firm, that led to the development of the Rally Fighter and so on.
So what's in a person's background is really the question, sort of how to get there. And often it's something that is, you know, what they have done belies where their passions are or what they've learned. If you look back in my history, you know, my grandfather started a disruptive steel making company, which took the idea of a mini mill of taking commonly available scrap steel and using the cost advantage of melting that down to make cheap steel profitable. Meaning like if you were going to build rebar, which is a cheap form of end product steel, you couldn't compete with it using a traditional development process. But when you change your development process, suddenly making rebar was profitable again. I grew up learning from my grandfather and he liked to make things. He ran a lightweight aggregates company along with that steel company and innovated in cement, seemingly boring industries, but you could really light the lamp and change the construction industry. It's not as sexy as certainly many of the products that we work on today, but I learned a lot from him. So long before sort of my traditional background, that was in, I would say, you know, my DNA and my early thoughts about what I was going to do. I think, you know, whatever it is genetically or built, I just loved to make things and see them become manifest. So that's where I approached college. I was quite frustrated in university because I was studying mechanical and aerospace engineering, and I found it to be so unapplied. And I found it to be so much more of like a liberal arts education applied to an engineering education, which I was told was the right way to do things. And I was sort of hungering for something that wouldn't be around for another 20 years, which was the idea of a nano degree and being able to learn and do quickly and evolve a science or a technology. And so after I had sort of begun to get toward my college years, I was feeling frustrated by the world that was around me in terms of making things. And being a banker for me taught me about the world of finance, but it was super frustrating also. I felt too disengaged or not involved. So it was important to learn about the world of finance. And I'm a chartered financial analyst, which I think helps you look at global markets and helps you look at, you know, sort of basic truths about risk capital and non-risk capital. You know, my particular form of banking was actually investing in banks. And so that is sort of like a hyper focus on risk and in a very pure way. And so that's where my finance background stands. And then as far as my time in the military, that's where things really began to break out for me. I loved my time in the military. It was about leading people. It put a real fine point in my training about what it means to lead in complex circumstances where you don't have all the answers, but you're asked, you don't have all the information, but you're asked to give answers. And you need to know when to say, I don't know. And you're bringing people along with you, and sometimes in the harshest of circumstances. And so, you know, there's no better training than that to learn how to do hard things with a team. So that's my background and where I came from. I do not consider Harvard Business School traditional. It's a traditional school. I had a hard time going. Of course, I was honored to get in, but, you know, I wasn't sure what it would do for my career. I had a mentor who was sure of what it would do for my career, and he was right. It's only as good as the students that are with you. And so it was full of students that really opened my eyes to many different industries. And it was the right springboard for me to launch Local Motors. So it was kind of the last step I took before launching this company. And I don't think I'd be here today if it wasn't for that time.
I'm curious, especially where you began in terms of learning at the knee of your grandfather, who was himself an entrepreneur, and perhaps, you know, awakening what was already there in your DNA to do something entrepreneurial yourself. But then sort of the frustrations with your own education. I'm curious the extent to which your children or grandchildren might be already children in your case, but grandchildren eventually learning at your knee. I wonder how you would advise them, you know, based on your own experience, should you find that they have a bent towards entrepreneurship, them or others who would seek your advice in terms of how best to approach this. You talked about some of the things that were problematic in your time at Princeton and your education in terms of it being overly theoretical and not so practical, my words, not yours. Whereas a lot of the sort of real world experience, learning to react quickly, to take what limited information you might have and make the best decisions possible. As you think about the roux that has been created that has led to your own success, what would you advise others in sort of assessing the things that were most essential for you in helping you become an entrepreneur?
Well, I mean, I advise my children, I have four boys and they're young, but they're, you know, certainly learning all the time. And they are in what I would call traditional school. You know, they have class from 8 a.m. until 3:30 in the afternoon and then sports and whatnot. But they are learning in a different way. And I think that I advise them that taking a language is a critically important thing for them. In some cases, two doesn't really matter to me, but I think that that's important. I see us as living in a passportless world in the future, and learning how to communicate is critically important. And so that's one very important feature of what I teach them, which is this idea of being from one country, let's call it German, American, Japanese, whatever. It is a different notion for them as they grow up. And so a digital citizen is really what's on my mind all the time for them. I think, you know, if I write my first book, you know, that's going to be the focus of it and talking about what it means for them all the way around. I don't think it's just focused on business. I think it's the way you set up your profile in life. It's the history that you're creating when you're going forward. I think it's the how you make friends. Clearly, we know, you know, how you integrate into a community like our community. You're building a digital record of what you're doing. And so thinking about that and being purposeful and understanding that failure is just part of a high clock speed in order to be able to get to success. You know, Tom Watson said it, he just didn't know the, you know, how meaningful perhaps it would be, but that, you know, success lies at the other side of failure. And so we have a higher clock speed in education right now. And so I advise them on that. Certainly learning how to understand both software and then embedded software. So robotics is something that's something that I very much encourage for them. There's so many ways to get your hands on it and to learn about it, because we're just on the, you know, the waking hours of artificial intelligence. And I know my 13-year-old, he, you know, had ideas about being a lawyer, but now he's really thought about the fact that it probably is true that, you know, IBM's Watson can scan legal code throughout its entire history and make a best fit guess as to what as facts are presented, what the response would be out of a jury or out of a judge. Might mean that some of the higher order human cognitive jobs, like being a lawyer or a doctor, could be replaced in bulk form by an artificial intelligence. So we talk about that. And we talk about how to be relevant in a world like that. And one of the things that I say is I believe in a soft deterministic world. So hard determinism to me really means that humans are going to be taken over by machines, and machines will then be smart enough to build machines, and humans will just be basically innocent bystanders in the world. And I just don't believe in that. I can't see it from a point of view of in my life, in their life, and in the lives beyond. The imagination and the sense of ingenuity and what you could think of as a spark of genius, then setting a machine to work to do complex tasks that a human can't do very well, that's more of a soft deterministic world. So, you know, when I advise people, and especially my kids, it gives them hope to think of it in that way, but it also gives them direction. Those are some of the things that I think about. I also think it's super important to learn to make. And so I learned to make in a wood shop and a metal shop. But I think learning to make when it comes to, you know, various forms of other technologies, material sciences, hugely important, becoming even more important daily. And so learning how to make with different forms of, you know, composites and metals and other things like that is critically important. Those are some of the things that I share with them.
It's interesting. I mean, I have sons as well, young ones also, and I've had a chance to visit with them your National Harbor, the DC area microfactory. And it's interesting that you actually have, at least in that one, if not all of them, I don't know, have set up courses for children to learn to make, to use mini 3D printers, to, you know, take an idea and see it through to its fruition and its creation. And so I see a lot of what you're advising and ways in which you're working with your own children applied even more broadly in some really interesting ways.
Well, thanks. And we have worked hard at that. Those are experiments for us. And I don't know whether they have a right place in a business or whether they are just learning about how to recruit a community or market products. What I can say is, one, thanks for going to National Harbor. And two, you know, I think that when you sell a high technology product like an Ollie, you know, it is something where you have a duty to be able to let people know what it is that they're buying. And Ollie has a large content of it that's 3D printed. A lot of people just don't know what 3D printing is, and we don't sell our vehicles on that attribute. You know, it's not like you wake up in the morning, you're like, I have a cold rolled steel, you know, high pressure formed, you know, super formed aluminum, you know, or steel vehicle, and that's why I bought it. You know, there's been some marketing over time, like, you know, when Ford switched to aluminum trucks, there was both positive and negative marketing around that from themselves and their competitors. But most of the time, material science isn't the selling point. Not even the making method is the selling point. What the selling point is the technology that you can put in it. So I think one of the reasons why we've really, you know, sort of pushed education in our sales locations like National Harbor is because it gets people to sort of ask the questions like, why do I care? And when they can see how quickly with retail 3D printers things can be created, I think that helps, you know, bring the message home. So also I have a feeling, you know, Eberhard von Kuhnheim was one of the real leaders in the automotive industry, you know, last generation, who created the modern BMW based on the idea that he wanted to have people aspire to buying that brand. So he thought deep 10 years in the future, you know, saying, I want people to aspire 10 years when they're 13 to buy their first car as a BMW when they're 23. And so I think you do have to deep seed in industries that are highly connected. It's not transactional like Evernote or like Snapchat. I think, you know, where you'll trade a social app and you probably won't be as wed to it as a brand. These are things that move you around and change your life. You know, that's something that, you know, I'm pretty passionate about. There are a lot of people that say that have made, I think, rash judgments and said, you know, people won't own a vehicle in the future because look at Uber. We just share vehicles now. I'm not sure that I subscribe to that at all. Not that I'm wistful about people driving around 12-cylinder Ferraris and, you know, that's the future that everyone's going to have. I just don't think we know what we know because we don't make enough. So if you think about a car as a $50,000 to $80,000 paperweight that depreciates the moment you drive it off the lot and is simply good for the engine rumble it has, I guarantee we're not going to be driving those in the future. But if you think about a car that could be a sub $10,000, highly technology enabled, bespoke part of your life that defines who you are and what you do better, I can certainly imagine people buying that. And especially if it was subscribed for, where you can upgrade it like an iPhone every year, I can see people buying that. But right now, the car industry doesn't know how to make that. So what they say is, well, since I can only make a hammer, I'm only going to hit nails. Which means since I only make 7-year depreciating assets that are highly complex and mass manufactured with huge tooling costs, that's the only thing that I'm going to be able to sell. So I have to have people share it because nobody wants to buy those things coming up. And so I think you have to train children in order to be able to think differently about subscription and upgradable hardware. And, you know, happily we have companies like Apple in front of us that are doing it. You know, their iPhone is an upgradable piece of hardware now, they say. You can buy it on the iPhone upgrade program. A little bit of a long-winded answer to how to teach children and why, but it's all wrapped together in how I feel about the evolution of these industries.
And how far do you think we are from that reality on a larger scale, people purchasing their own automobiles, for instance, in that fashion? And how quickly do you think like your company will be a significant part of that?
Listen, I think revolutions are silent. And so some of the biggest ones, and so some of them are like the French Revolution, where it's loud and there's a bang and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, a lot of them are silent, like the internet revolution. And so another one that was sort of silent is, you know, everyone was riding horses around in 1915. People in New York were apoplectically fearful of the load of manure that was going to be on the streets of New York within a year. And so then, you know, automotive vehicles took over quickly. You know, Henry Ford made 15 million Model Ts in, you know, 5 years. And so I think that you ask how long. It's not going to happen slowly. It's going to happen aggressively. And so if you think about some of the drivers that are out there, you know, I can't tell you whether it's, you know, March of 2018 or whether it's, you know, November of, you know, 19, but we're looking at it in the next 5 years. And when I say it, what I'm thinking about is like, look at how you buy a vehicle now. Most people buy a vehicle through a dealership. We certainly do that in the United States, but even in Europe and in India, it's the same thing. And when I say vehicle, it could be a Hero motorcycle in India, you know, or it could be a Mercedes in Germany. And so we push them on people. It's a supply-driven economy. And so those things die hard. You know, the factory that's at Hero is going to keep making a motorcycle every 2 seconds, and that's mass manufacturing. So those things are a force that's pushing hard. And the only force that's strong enough to push back on it is customers. If they simply say, I don't want to buy, then that's going to change things overnight. And so where it tips is finding technologies and vehicles that change people's minds. And that's hard. That's why it hasn't happened, you know, in the last 120 years, because we have a very entrenched industry that says this is how it's always been done. And, you know, come on, this is a big boy game. Don't get involved. And that scared a lot of people off, but it didn't scare everyone off. And, you know, Tesla was a really important part of that changing. I give a lot of credit to, you know, Martin Eberhard and Mark Parpenning for founding Tesla and for going off. I give a lot of credit to Elon Musk for picking up what they started and taking it along. And it made regulators and customers change their mind. That was a silent revolution. If you ask people before the Tesla Model S came along, would you ever think about buying 100,000? If I took like 10 people off the business streets of New York, would you, or maybe that's a bad city because most people don't have driver's licenses there. But right. Let's think about Dallas or let's think about Geneva. If you ask them whether they would think about buying a $100,000 car, I think they would have told you, I'm not in the market for a sports car. And today they find a way to change whatever they would have paid for within their, you know, daily life and work to make that money available for at least a lease on a Model S. And those are the early adopters. And they would never have described themselves as car folk before. And so, you know, Geneva has the highest adoption of Teslas in the world. And I think you find it when you talk to people about that. And it's interesting when you look around it, we gave an EV subsidy to our company to test this feature out. And Jacqueline, in fact, has been co-authoring a blog with those people in our company. And it's been fascinating to watch because you'll see in our company, we give a small subsidy for people, but they have taken up Bolts and Bolts and Teslas and Leafs. And many of them, I think, would have rolled over in their grave before they thought they were buying such a vehicle. So the revolution is happening. And then as we go beyond EV and we start to look at self-driving technologies, that's really going to turbocharge it because, you know, 95% of accidents on the highway are human engendered. And so it's unacceptable the way we drive distracted. And so there are real forces at work that are going to make that change tip very quickly. But it has to be driven by technology. And we're already seeing self-driving attributes in cars. Once it clicks over, it's going to feel like it's overnight. Because people will say, I'll just hit this button and this vehicle can take me where I want to go largely. And in some cases, it'll start within a city and not go on a highway. And in other cases, it'll start on a highway and not go in a city. And then those will merge together. and we'll have sort of ubiquitous solutions. What I think is interesting is that technology, the cost of it is going to get driven down very low. You already see that with companies like Mobileye, where there's a lot of price pressure on what would have looked like super awesome hardware and software just a year ago. And reading Morgan Stanley's report on that, and I think, you know, that team is right. A lot of price pressure. So you got to make cars cheaper and tech cheaper, because we're constantly going to be looking for the utility of what those new technologies will bring us. That's my thought on the revolution and when it's happening.
Thank you so much for your time today, Jay.
Thanks so much.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World-Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World-Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World-Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of world-class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.